Session number 952.
Colonel Chaplain Reel 1. How did you come to join the army in the first place, Colonel Chaplain?
From a very early age, I'd been very keen on lead soldiers to start off with. And as I say, from a very early age, it had always been my intention to go into the army. I was also particularly fond of horses, and I was determined to get into a regiment where the horse would be available for me. At school I joined the army class at a very early age, and took the army exam at Burlington House. It's the civil service exam that one used to have to take for the army. And got into the Royal Military Academy at Woolwich. And from there I joined the Royal Artillery, which was what I'd always intended to do, that is to join a horse regiment.
And you joined, you were first of all in the early 30s in the heavy brigade, Royal Artillery. Did they have horses at that time?
The heavy brigade was a funny mixture. It had heavy guns, which were very seldom used, but it also had field guns, which we used more often, and we did most of our training with field guns. We had horses. For instance, we were allowed chargers and so on, but they were not part of our work. The work part was mechanized. The guns were drawn by tractors and not by horses.
When did you hear that you were going to India?
The major of my battery in England had been in India and had been commanding a battery. He had always impressed upon me how pleasant life was, particularly in mountain artillery. And when he left the battery to go to command the 24th Mountain Regiment in India, he wrote to me and said that he would one day try and get me out to join the regiment. And this he did, and in 1936 I was asked to go out to India to a mountain battery. This was unusual because normally one had to serve with British soldiers in India for a year or two before going to mountain artillery. But I went straight to a mountain battery, at Indian Troop Mountain Battery.
What had you heard about soldiering in India which had impressed you before you went?
The major that I was talking about had shown me many photographs of Indian soldiers, of the mountain gun, of the ponies and the mules and so on, and the fact that there might be some action on the northwest frontier, which was always in a mountain battery's possible for a mountain battery officer to get, I think spurred me on to going to mountain artillery.
Did you travel to India in a troop ship?
I did. I travelled in the troop ship Somersetshire.
And what were conditions like on it?
The conditions for officers were really very good. I shared a cabin with a captain in the same regiment, and we were very comfortable indeed. The conditions for the soldiers, on the other hand, were by no means as good. The soldiers lived on mess decks, and they were given hammocks. A mess deck might take a considerable number of men, say 100 to 200 men. They were supposed to sling their hammocks at night, and packed their hammocks up in the daytime, and on those mess decks they had tables and chairs on which they had their meals. It wasn't too bad if the weather was all right, but as soon as there was a lot of heavy weather, the soldiers did suffer a lot. As orderly officer, one had to inspect the troop decks, and that meant going through every troop deck, and it wasn't a very pleasant operation. Men normally hadn't slung their hammocks, were lying on the floor. A lot of them had been sick, and the stench from a troop deck was something to be believed.
And what about your own accommodation as an officer? What did that consist of?
Well, it was a quite a pleasant cabin. In my case, it was a cabin with two berths. I had the top one, and the captain had the bottom berth. We were on B deck, I think it was, a large porthole, and a basin where you could wash and shave in the mornings. For a bath, you had to go along the corridor to a bathroom.
And how did you keep yourselves entertained?
There were deck sports, which gave us quite a good opportunity to have exercise, deck tennis, and those games where you push wooden blocks along with a broom handle type thing. We rigged up a swimming pool for the men, and when we got into the Mediterranean, we had a certain amount of exercise in that. And of course there were women on board, and there were parties, and one played bridge and poker and so on, and there was quite a lot to do in the evenings.
Who were the women on board?
The women were mostly the wives of officers actually travelling, or wives going out to India to join their husbands, and some sisters of the QAINMS.
And did you have dances?
Yes, there were. There were dances organised, and we, in fact, had, I can remember very well, a very good fancy dress dance, in which I, having bought a red fez at Port Said, went as an Arab boy. A friend of mine gave me some stuff to put on my face to make it brown, saying that it would wash off quite easily, and it took a very long time to get rid of my brown skin.
Did the men go to the dances, or was it just for officers?
No, these were only for officers.
How long did the journey take?
It took, I think I'm right in saying, about 21 days.
And where did you disembark?
We finally disembarked at Karachi, but there was one thing I would like to mention. That is that we stopped for a bit at Port Said, and at Port Said we had to organize a route march for our soldiers. I was in charge of a draft, and I had to take my soldiers on this route march. On the boat, I had been wearing shorts, stockings and shoes, and uniform shirt. But for the route march, we were told we must wear our proper uniform and boots. Now, the only boots that I had were field boots and thick breeches. And a route march in Port Said in field boots and thick breeches was no fun, I can assure you.
This was just to get you out of the ship while something was happening on board ship, was it?
Well, no, it was mostly to give the men a chance of exercise, make certain that they all did be able to stretch their legs properly.
So hadn't you taken out any tropical kit from England?
No, funnily enough, we were advised not to to take out things like breeches, uniform coats and so on, because the Indian dersey, we were told, was very good at making them up, particularly if he had a good one to copy. So what we used to do was we took out a good pair of English breeches made by somebody like Huntsman, and then the dersey would take them to pieces, copy them out in brown paper, and keep them for the rest of your time in India. So whenever you wanted a pair of breeches, you merely wrote to your tailor, wherever he happened to be, and said, I want a pair of polo breeches, or I want uniform breeches, or whatever you wanted. The only item of tropical kit that we did take out with us was a thing called the Woolsey Topi, which was the one that we only wore on ceremonial parades. Normally, on ordinary parades, you wore a thick pith helmet, the brim of which was over an inch thick. The Woolsey Topi looked more like a Royal Marine bandsman's hat that you see nowadays, and that you used only on ceremonial parades.
Which did you prefer wearing, if either?
Oh, the proper pith helmet, the thick one, was a much more comfortable one. The Woolsey Topi, apart from anything else, had they both had, but it had a draft or an air excluder in the top. The top part was fixed so that there were gaps in it, and the air could get out. But it also had what were like four little spikes that used to rest on top of your head, and it was most uncomfortable.
The spikes were for what?
Well, merely to keep a gap between your head and the topi, and the top of the topi, so that the air could get out.
And what were the spikes made out of?
Well, they were metal, brass. They were sort of brass studs. But I don't know whether it was the shape of my head or not, but it was certainly most uncomfortable.
Did the uniform in India generally prove suitable for Indian conditions?
The uniform we wore, yes, but we tended to change during the time that I was there. When I first went out, we were inclined to wear breeches and leggings and brown boots. Now, that is the kit that Kipling talked about, mountain gunners in their brown gaiters. From that, we tended to go to breeches and puttees and boots. And eventually, a lot of regiments and batteries changed to shorts and puttees and boots. And that was perhaps the best form of equipment for a mountain gunner, because you could ride in it and you could march in it as well. You could do both things, and you were expected to do both things.
So you felt that the changes were for the better?
Yes, I think so. The changes became a bit exaggerated in 1939, at the beginning of the war, in that they produced a form of trousers for use in Burma, which were very bad. That was a type of trousers which you could wear long with anklets, or roll up and wear as shorts. And when you did use them as shorts, they got full of muck, dust, and were most uncomfortable. Generally speaking, you tended to keep them long. You had to keep them long because of mosquitoes at night particularly, but eventually we got down to always using the long trousers, not the shorts.
What type of kit did you have when you dressed for dinner? Did you have any special kit?
Yes, we wore ordinary mess kit. In Quetta, where it was cold enough, you wore the ordinary Royal Artillery mess kit, which was blue with red facings and red blue breeches with red facing with red stripes, and of course spurs. On some nights, and it was mostly at weekends, you wore a dinner jacket for dinner. Now, if you were in a very hot station, you would wear a white monkey jacket with regimental badges, and your ordinary blue and red overalls.
What exactly do you mean by a monkey jacket?
A monkey jacket is the sort of jacket that you see a lot of waiters wearing, which comes to a point in the middle of the back and two points on either side in front. A short jacket which is worn with a cummerbund. And of course we wore cummerbunds mostly with uniform if you were wearing a white type uniform.
What colour cummerbund?
The Mountain Artillery was a pale blue.
Coming back to your arrival in India, which port did you arrive at?
We arrived at Karachi.
And what happened to you at disembarkation? Can you recollect?
Yes, I was met on the quayside by an Indian gentleman who told me that he was my bearer, and he had a letter from the colonel to me giving me instructions as to where I would stay the night, what train I would get the next day, and so on, to get me up to where the regiment was, which was at Sibi.
And what was the name of your bearer?
The bearer was called Zain Khan, a most wonderful old gentleman who was... His only worry really was that he only had two chits. All bearers had to produce chits for their masters, they seemed to take a pride in being able to produce a lot of these chits to show that their services had been very good. In this case, there were only two chits, and Zain Khan felt that he'd been done down because he only had two chits. But one was for, I think, 7 years, and one for about 15 years, so there was little doubt that he would be the perfect servant as far as I was concerned.
What did Zain Khan look like?
He was tall, thin. He wore a greyish beard which he hennaed so that at times it was red. He wore the same sort of... he looked rather like a Pathan. He wore very much the clothes of the same type of clothes as a Pathan. Generally red slippers with turned up toes. Baggy trousers, baggy white trousers, and a shirt hanging outside the trousers. Now, if he was actually serving in mess or had to be in uniform, then he would wear a long white coat with a cummerbund, a belt, in the regimental colours. His pagri or turban was tied in the Punjabi Musliman way, that is, on a sort of gold-looking skull cap. The very, very long white cloth is bound round so that on one side it's rolled up and it produces a series of rings And on the other side, it's flat against the head, so that on one side you've got a sort of corrugated effect, and on the other side, flat on the head. Finally, finishing up with a big piece which sticks out of the top and arches over to form a rather pleasant-looking fan.
In some particular colour?
In white. And on top of that, you have, again, a regimental band going round it with the regimental badge in the middle of it. So the right above the centre of his forehead is this regimental badge.
Can you remember what his chit said about him?
Yes, they were both written by very senior officers, and they were that his work in every way was excellent and you wouldn't get a better bearer anywhere in India.
And was that true?
That was certainly very true from every point of view. He, I have never met a servant, and I've known servants in Greek, Turkish, Arabs of different types, Sudanese, and not a single one of them has ever come up to the standard that Zain Khan had.
Why was he so good?
Well, his whole life was built up around you, intent on looking after you from every point of view. As an example, the first night I went out to a party, and on my return he was sitting outside my room, and I said, what you're doing here? And he said, oh, well, I never go to sleep until you're back in your bed. From every point of view, he did nothing but look after me. He was considerably older than I was, and of course there were occasions when he even advised me. He would say, Saab, you have been drinking far too much. I think you should be a bit more careful. He was, in every way, I think, the perfect servant.
How did you react when he told you that you'd been drinking too much?
I took it in the good faith that it was meant. I don't know whether it curbed me from drinking, but certainly it brought it to my notice.
I think you told me that sometimes these servants were a bit too fussy about feeling that they had to have something to do.
Yes, I think so. I couldn't quite fall in with their ideas of dressing you, which is really what they used to do. All your clothes would be prepared, and that was fair enough. But when it came to lifting up the ends of your trousers so that they wouldn't fall in the dirt while you were putting them on, I found that was a bit too much, and I told Zain Khan that it wasn't necessary for him to dress me. But on the other hand, it was very useful if you were putting on your mess kit, for instance, your stiff shirt, your overalls and Wellington boots. They were sometimes quite difficult to get on, and your brown boots were sometimes difficult to get on, and they were certainly difficult to get off, and in that case one used them to help you. For instance, Zain Khan would always take my field boots off, and the method of doing it would be that I would stick my leg out, sitting on the bed, say, I would stick my leg out, he would go astride it like a horse with his back to me. I would place my other foot on his bottom and push, and off would come the boot. And this was the ordinary way one took off one's boots. One had a boot jack as well, but it was easier doing it with the bearer.
And you also told me that sometimes at table they would rearrange things unnecessarily.
Yes, you had... in mess, your bearer always stood behind you, and it was up to him to see that you had everything that you required. Zain Khan had a very happy knack of knowing exactly when I wanted anything. If I wanted the sugar to put on my, whatever it happened to be, if I had lucky enough to have strawberries, we'll say, he would produce it. It would be at my elbow straight away. The same if you required the salt or whatever you wanted, he always seemed to know and would always produce it. But there was a certain amount of competition between bearers as they stood behind their sabs, and they tended to try and show that they were keen by moving things nearer their sab, very often things that he didn't want. And it was rather like a game of chess. And I can remember on one occasion a friend of mine, Bill Courtney, when a bearer moved something over something else, Bill moved another piece back and said, "Mate." But on the whole, they were most attentive and very, very good servants.
Were they honest?
My servants were all completely honest in every way. I have heard cases of where people have lost money and so on, but in my case it never happened at all. And in fact, my bearer was my banker. In India, one tended never to carry money. I mean, even in church, you signed a chit for the collection. You just didn't have money on you at any time. So that if you went down the bazaar to buy things, either you had a bill sent up, or your bearer would go with you and he would pay the bills. And he would keep an account and let you know what he'd spent. And the same if you needed shaving soap or something, you'd send your bearer off for it. You would never go and buy it yourself. And he would just produce a bill and you would pay him. And from that point of view, he was always completely honest.
So you never had to dismiss a servant in India?
I didn't dismiss a single servant the whole of my time in India. I've known cases of people who have dismissed servants, but I certainly never did.
How did you pay them?
We paid them a very small sum, actually. When I first started, Zain Khan used to get 15 rupees a month. And a rupee was only one and threepence in those days, so it was a very paltry sum. But there were certain perks that a bearer had which made life a bit more easy for him, in that very often he had rations from the cookhouse. He lived nearly always behind you in the bungalow, in a small part of the bungalow behind. A lot of them used to get rations from the cookhouse. I think that was unofficial, but they certainly used to do it. They were always helped on holidays and big days. I always used to give them good presents and so on at Christmas time. But one realized that the 15 rupees was a very, very small sum.
Did you pay your other servants through the bearer, or did you pay them individually?
I paid mine through my bearer. I was trying to think. In married bungalows, I don't know whether it was always done through the bearer. I should think it was. I think in the main we did pay them through our bearer.
Once a week or once a month?
Once a month.